I wanted to move the dialogue into a slightly different direction and talk about what I see as actually a remarkable phenomenon that is currently going on in Israel today and in other places, but specifically in Israel, and especially in religious Zionist circles. It's a phenomenon that's known by its acronym, Habakkuk. And Habakkuk is an acronym for an amalgam of different spiritual influences, Chabad, Breslov, Rav Kook, Shlomo Karlbach. These are the kinds of names that are incorporated under this one term. And what this movement seeks to incorporate are in these disparate influences is basically a search for a certain kind of primal spiritual experience. And I'm very interested in things like this. Why has Habakkuk taken hold? Indeed, if you think about it, just the offshoots of this, why are literally thousands of people traveling to Uman every year to visit the grave of Rabbi Nachman? And I'm wondering ultimately if, and you know, another phenomenon that everybody is aware of is the incredible growth of Karlbach Minyanim literally in the last 10 years after the death of Shlomo Karlbach, last, I guess, 13 years now. These trends, do they constitute a kind of implicit critique, really, of normative Judaism in the sense that just, you know, sort of normal orthodoxy, normal going to shul, normal mitzvot practice cannot satisfy people's spiritual needs?
I want to preface my remarks with an essay by Rav Kook, and it's called Le Mahalach HaIdeot BeYisrael, which is very difficult to translate into English. The process of ideas in Israel. And what Rav Kook shows us in that essay is that within Judaism, there have always been two currents. There's been what he calls the Limudi, which is the scholastic or academic. You know, it's an intellectual Judaism. It's book learning. As opposed to another stream within Judaism, which he calls, in very good Hebrew, charismati. It's the charismatic approach. It's the charisma. And that's what the Baal Shem Tov was all about, says Rav Kook. To be fair, he says that the Vilna Gaon also had a charismatic side to him, but that was not as important for the Gaon as was Torah learning. And so the charismatic aspect of the Gaon's personality was de-emphasized, whereas the Baal Shem Tov and his Talmidim played it up. Now, Professor Malamed has said that you have this phenomenon in Israel today, which goes by the acronym Habakkuk, Chabad, Breslov, Kook, Karlbach. What is it all about? There's an intense yearning, a longing, a thirst for spirituality, because Jews, and I imagine especially young Jews, are dissatisfied with a Judaism which is of the head, of the intellect. They're looking for something more than that. And they find it in these various movements. In other words, a young Jew walks into a conventional synagogue and he's bored silly. Whereas he goes to a Karlbach Minyan and it speaks to him or her. And that explains the profusion now of these Kalbach minyanim. This is a phenomenon which is spreading all around the globe. I want to analyze what these movements have in common, what the different nuances are. Are they mutually compatible or incompatible? Can you really be a Chabad cook? Can you really be Chabad Breslov cook Kalbach? Okay. And I'm going to speak from my own personal experience. My first exposure to any of these movements was Chabad. And I was very taken by this vision of reality that I referred to before. Call it pantheism, perhaps panentheism. And from there I went to Rav Kook, and I saw that he too shares this vision of reality in his works. It suffuses all of his works, Avot HaKodesh, etc., etc. Which is no wonder, because he was at least half a Chabadsker. His mother was Chabad. His father was a Voloshner. And Leah, we were discussing the fact that he says, Nishmati krua, my soul is torn. Well, you can understand very well, if your father is a graduate of the Voloshner Yeshiva, and your mother is a Chabad Chassidista, you would be torn. And his entire life is an attempt to bridge the gap between what he calls the Limudi and the Charismati. Afterwards, I saw in Breslov too, there is this vision, because Rav Nachman of Breslov is the great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. You study Likutei Moran, you also get this vision of how God is Mimalei Kol Almin, that God is in the chair, is in the microphone. Rav Shlomo Kalbach, Zichron Livrach, I don't recall him discussing this. Did he too adhere to this vision? I don't know. I imagine so. He spent enough time in Chabad and in Breslov, and he studied enough Rav Kook, but I don't recall him speaking in such terms. I think his focus was elsewhere. How compatible are these movements to one another? Well, first of all, you know, a lot of the people in Chabad or in Breslov are anti-Zionists. So they would have a difficult time also being kuknikim, because to be a kuknik in this time pretty much means that you're a Zionist. Although not necessarily so, but most of the people who follow Rav Kook nowadays would define themselves as Zionists. So that's one mutual antagonism I foresee. Let's say Rav Shlomo Kalbach. You get into difficulty there, because he had certain kulot, he had certain leniencies when it came to touching and hugging, etc. Some of these other groups would not be thrilled with that, you know, whether it's Rav Kook or Chabad. So there are various touchstones. But it's possible that what they all have in common is stronger than what pits them against each other. And that is, as I said, this tremendous longing and thirst for spirituality.
If I could, I would like to place this phenomenon in a more global context. I think there is no doubt that what we are witnessing in Habakkuk is part of what, for the lack of better terms, I would have to call postmodern, postcolonial, post-industrial, call it what you want, world, in which similar, comparable, not the same, but comparable trends are very visible in all the other major religions. I live in England, where I must say I am a little uncomfortable with... I'm a little uncomfortable when I pass two former pubs in the area where I live. You know, corner pubs, which were places where people used to come and drink and get drunk, and on Saturday night they'll be rolling in the gutter.
That was great.
They have been converted. They have been converted to two New Age Anglican churches. The big Anglican churches that were built all over England in the 19th century, huge neo-Gothic structures meant to contain hundreds of worshippers, are empty. They're dying. They're now converting them to sports center or scout centers or... But new small shtiblech, effectively, little former pubs are now forming where white-collar, middle-class, white people, 30s, 40s, quite well-to-do. These are not evangelical churches serving poor black communities, of which we also have a lot in London. These are middle-class white people who are meeting every Sunday with guitars and tambourines, and they're dancing, and they're speaking in voices, and they're having all kinds of charismatic experiences. We see comparable phenomena in the Muslim world. I mean, they have assumed perhaps a violent and not a very pleasant face in certain quarters. But what I wanted to stress is that we are witnessing... You know, we are witnessing the end of modernity. We have entered another phase. There's a new paradigm. I am old enough, and I think there are enough people in this hall who are old enough with me to remember that when I became intellectually mature, when I came to university, I took it for granted, as everyone around me who was mouthing Marxist slogans and so on, that we have reached the end of religion. It's a matter of time, another two, three, four, five decades, by the end of the millennium. By religion is becoming more and more irrelevant, it is diminishing, it's dying. We have witnessed a complete overturn, you know, something that was inconceivable, I think, for members of my generation at that point. And I do see the Habakkuk phenomenon as part of that. And one other comment, if I may, in response to Bezalel's observation about Nikutei Mohoran, Braslav, reading Braslav. Part of the same thing, at least for me, who has been interested in Braslav literature for a very long time, and I've been reading it for years, I've also witnessed a new reading of Braslav. I think Braslav was read until the 60s and 70s as an answer for people who are seeking faith in a world in which it's absolutely impossible to sustain it, unless one suspends all judgments. I mean, faith against all evidence to the contrary. People found in Rabbi Nachman a voice for the sense that God is unreachable, not that he is, he is not memale kol albin, sovev kol albin. He is surrounding, but he is not present. God is beyond our reach. That was how Braslav was read by my teacher, Yosef Weiss. And under his influence, a whole generation of scholars read Braslav like that. Perhaps the most accessible presentation in English of Braslav in that light is Arthur Green's biography of Nachman of Braslav, Tormented Master, which some of you may have read. He still finds Braslav speaking for people who have faith, but have faith against evidence of the contrary, because there is no way that we can reach God in our world. It is a world in which God is too far, too remote. It is outside. It is transcendent, not immanent. And now, Braslav is read as dripping with immanent God. And the current chief interpreter of Braslav for this generation, Zvi Mag, a young scholar in Israel, his first book is about to be translated into English, and I think it is an excellent study, reads Braslav completely differently. He finds God very present in Braslav teachings. And there's one particular teaching, one Torah in Likutei Mohoran, Samach Daled, Boel Paro, which is the one around which a lot of the debate about which way is the Nachman of Braslav to be understood. He completely reverses the traditional understanding of that Torah, which was understood as a particular interpretation of the Lurianic Kabbalah, of the idea of Tzimtzum as God having evacuated himself out of out of the space into which the world was to be created. The world couldn't have been created in the midst of the infinity that is God. It would have been instantly shattered. So God had to create an empty space, move himself outwards, and in that space, empty of God, he planted our world. So the world is in fact a space devoid of the divine presence. The divine presence is all around it, but not within it. And that teaching of Nachman of Breslov was understood as Nachman of Breslov's grappling with this idea. Whereas Tzvi completely reverses the interpretation and finds the final passages of that Torah to be finding a way of seeing God within it. And I think he might well be right, but there's a complete reversal which is correct.
I'm next. Okay, I want to look at this a little bit differently. I think the question is not this real Habakkuk phenomenon, which is itself a very small number of people. I think the more important question is the influence of all of this kind of stuff on the general Orthodox community. And what one finds by going to a college campus or something is that the primary influences of all of these things we're talking about are those of Shlomo Kalbach in both music and teaching, and Chabad. Typical at least a U.S. Orthodox campus group on the large campuses, of which there are a number with hundreds of kids, are Shiurim and Tanya given by the Chabad campus rabbi, who mostly works with non-Orthodox kids, but to some of the Orthodox kids, and Shlomo Kalbach music becoming increasingly significant as it's also becoming in the general Orthodox community. Now, one reason for this is clearly that, unfortunately, the complex problems of Shlomo Kalbach himself no longer were there to prevent his total integration into the community after he passed away. This is part of the tragedy of this man, and that's just the reality. That's a part of what's going on. But much of what's going on is also the breakdown of traditional synagogue music, the elimination of chazanut, then the forgetting of the melodies. Then a guy can come, and Shlomo did this literally, and take the minor key out from the major key out on Friday night and put the minor key, which would send through the floor any real chazan, because it's totally considered to be like horrible. Friday night you're supposed to daven in the major key. So he could do this and create the Kalbach Friday night davening and get away with it, because there is an overall breakdown. This has nothing to do with any things we're talking about besides this. There's an overall breakdown in the meaningfulness of synagogue music among the young people, partly because nobody sings anymore, because even though you could sit around all day with some of these guys, the fact is that the real chazanim knew the real nusach. And so when it died, as it is dying in front of our faces, in case you don't know that, right? As it died, Shlomo Kalbach is filling the void, and it's dying because the old one isn't meaningful. Singing Adon Olam, you know, from a melody from you know, who knows, right, the Weimar Republic, is not what the young people want. Now, coincidentally, this is really funny. Only a small percentage of Chabad music can fill this void, because all the Russian Lubavitch Nigunim are also dead. They're dead everywhere except among Lubavitch. No one will sing the Russian Nigunim, except certain small number. And the young people who are influenced by Hasidic music in general, they're influenced most by this neo-Hasidic, you know, Shweki and right, all this kind of stuff, right? And certain small number of Lubavitch Nigunim, but they're real. So what's going on is that Kalbach, and to some extent the Tanya, are influencing the regular Orthodox community, as well as the obvious fact that we all know that many Lubavitch ideas have totally taken over the regular Orthodox community, ideas of outreach and how you deal with the people that aren't religious. So it's completely became normative despite all the conflicts that we're talking about. So as all of this happened, right, the phenomenon that we see is not evaluatable by the question of whether or not Shlomo Kalbach, who's a Zionist, could be acceptable to a real Bratzlaver who isn't a Zionist. That's not the question in the Young Israel of X, where a bunch of young people want to make a Kalbach minyan. And so this music problem is connected with the spirituality problem. It's not some unimportant thing. It's that we are standing now at a circumstance similar to the Baal Shem Tov in his days, when he made that famous remark when he came into a shul and he said, well, I can't get in. I think it was the Baal Shem Tov. I can't get in. And they said, what do you mean you can't get in? He said, because the problem is that all the prayers are on the floor here, and there's no way that I can walk into the shul. And this is the problem which we can't address here, we don't have time for, that so many people find that they don't know how to make tefillah meaningful. And so into this is coming this new form of music in our culture. This is not the same as the integration of the ideas of these groups that is happening with a small number of people in Israel who are being discussed. And the only last point that I want to make about this is that I think that we find that in the intellectual classes of our Orthodox community, there are small numbers of people who are studying some of these things, like the works of Rav Kook. But for most people, these things are of no interest, because ironically, while the phenomenon I've just described is going on, they're being bombarded with art scroll, for whom all this is forbidden and considered to be heresy. And that's a very interesting phenomenon of these two things happening at the same time.
I must say that this question, when I first saw it on paper, took me somewhat by surprise, because I also heard about the Habakkuk phenomenon, but without the Karlbach element. And I actually know people who are very enamored with Chabad teachings, Breslov and Rav Kook, and somehow managed to make what to me is almost an impossible shidduch between the three, and live comfortably in all of these texts and somehow amalgamate them. But I just make the following observations. First of all, the Karlbach music element, I think is, you know, just like an appeal to the sort of hippie groups in the 70s or the 60s, this is a group to which it still appeals to. People who have no connection whatsoever with Chabad or with Breslov or with Rav Kook. But there are also the usage of Karlbach music amongst in the way that that has been explained. One of the things that people are looking for is in-depth theological study. Now, it's true that outside of Chabad, you can get this in small pockets, or Ramchal, which are taught in other organizations. But people who really want something to immerse themselves in, and this is not just in Habakkuk circles, it could be Gerach Hasidim or Vizhnitz Hasidim, who have this relationship with Chabad studies, and it's a growing phenomenon. There are hundreds of them. It's not an exaggeration of people in the Hasidic world who are studying Chabad texts, and in some cases Breslov texts, even going to Uman, although they don't belong to Breslov Hasidim officially, but they go on the pilgrimage for Rosh Hashanah or whatever else it is that they do, because they're looking for Haskalah Elokit, godly intellectual, not just the pilpul of the Nigla and the Halacha that is taught in the yeshivas. Another point is Habakkuk phenomenon is because a lot of people cannot pigeonhole themselves into one particular box. They like certain aspects of Chabad, but then they hate other aspects. Not necessarily of the real Chabad. It could be of the way that Chabad has sociologically orientated itself. It's made itself. They may relate to the study of Hasidus. They may even relate to the notion of the Rebbe. But they don't necessarily affiliate sociologically with many of the Chabad communities. They may like Breslov in certain respects, but then they have a strong Zionist bent. So therefore they need Rav Kook as well. And all of these things create new systems of people who refuse to define themselves and join the ever-increasing polarization of Orthodox Jewry, where everyone has a label and everyone belongs to a particular institution and only sends the children to that school and not to the other school, the shul you go to and the shul that you wouldn't step foot in even if they paid you $1 million. And that whole phenomenon. So the Habakkuk is saying, no, we want to drop all these. We don't want to be bound by these conventions. We want to live above and beyond. We want to relate to the truisms presented by these various thinkers, and that is what we want. And one has in the Israeli yeshivas, in the Dati Le'umi yeshivas, strong groups, for example, of people who study Chabad Hasidus as well. They wouldn't describe themselves as Chabad, they may even serve in the army, they may consider themselves Zionist or whatever else they do consider, but they are studying Hasidus. I've even seen journals from yeshivas, Datilomi, Haredilomi yeshivas, with articles written by Ramim or Talmidim in the yeshiva on Chabad Hasidus, using Chabad terminology, clearly familiar with the Chabad lexicon, but respectfully referring to all the rebbes of Chabad, but they don't see themselves as part of the Lubavitch community. You have that, for example, even in a certain sense in Rav Steinsaltz, who has ambiguously described himself as Chabad but not Lubavitch. Whatever that's supposed to mean, he identifies with even with the Rebbe, but not with all the trappings that have become conventional Chabad today. I would like to, one final point on this level is to mention also that which Professor Schiffman said before, the Chabad is a modern Orthodox movement, or the people in Chabad are modern Orthodox. Now, it is true that there are an untold number of Chabad couples that would fit in nicely in modern Orthodox society. But Chabad is as broad a church as ever, and there are modern Orthodox elements. There are extremely anti-modern elements within Chabad, and I don't just mean in the doctrine of Chabad. I'm talking mainly about many Chabad couples, large numbers of Chabad couples who identify themselves with ultra-Haredi groups and exist within ultra-Haredi society, so that it's becoming multicolored. There isn't this one dimension of Chabad, one type of Chabad anymore. There are so many different types spread across the different communities, even people who are fully-fledged Chabad. So the idea of trying to say the Chabad is this or that, it is becoming extremely broad, to the extent that people from the outside often say, well, Chabad is all of one color. It's actually very different. Even with Zionism, there are Chabad people today, and this actually is rooted a little bit, and I say this with caution, in the Rebbe himself. I once had a conversation, excuse me for this indulgence, because you'll find this interesting, I once had a conversation with Rabbi Tuvia Bloy, Chabad in Israel, thinker, Hogedeyot, and has written quite a lot. And he believes that the Rebbe was essentially anti-Zionist. And I showed him various letters of the Rebbe and Sichas, which could be seen in an extremely Zionistic light. And he said to me, he said, Reb Chaim, he said, Oriel Zimmer, who was an extremely anti-Zionist, anchored in Mitzuri Karta, who was very enamored with the Rebbe and became close with the Rebbe, sat with the Rebbe for 4 hours in Yechidus, and he came and he discussed these very issues, and he came out no problem. He came out in perfect peace with the Rebbe's views and his own anti-Zionist agenda. I said, Reb Tuvia, he said, it can't be. He said, the Rebbe wouldn't have told him something wrong, or he wouldn't have fabricated something for him. It must be, he said, that the Rebbe was anti-Zionist. I said, Reb Tuvia, I said, what you're saying is wonderful. I said, I've only got one problem. But Zalman Shazar also sat for 4 hours with the Rebbe in Yechidus and came out in perfect peace and in comfort with the Rebbe's ideas. So, this is a very strange thing, I said. So how do you explain that? Now, this is an extremely difficult issue. People like to oversimplify it, what the Rebbe's attitude to Zionism. It is one of the most perplexing sugyot in the Rebbe's thinking and theology. The word paradox that was used before comes to mind again here. People have accused the Rebbe of being the arch anti-Zionist, and seen Zionist writers describing him as, the Antichrist of Zionism. And then you have Satme Hasidim, who consider the Rebbe to be Zionism incarnate. So it's a very strange thing. And in Chabad families, you have Chabad who are identified with Haredi Lu'umi. They'll be standing there in Gush Katif protesting together with the same agenda, Arutz Sheva, and all that type of stuff. And then you have Chabad families who will identify with an extreme. They will explain the Rebbe's view about the Shtachim and so on, but they will see the Rebbe in very anti-Zionist colors. So therefore, the emergence of Habakkuk with all these paradoxes within the Rebbe himself and within the Chabad community allows, especially now after the Rebbe's passing, where the, you know, where interpretation runs wild, for people to create all these amalgamations and not feel that there is any contradiction.
I'm thinking about this image of Chabad couples and thinking about something we haven't talked about, which is women in Chassidut. I think that, especially for outsiders, there's a real kind of almost kind of stereotyping, a common perception of gender roles in Hasidic families, even above and beyond normal stereotypes of gender roles in Orthodox or even Haredi families. And I'm wondering if you know, a phrase like feminist Hasidut would be an oxymoron, or whether there is, you know, possibilities, areas where Hasidic women are actually more involved in modernity than their Midnagdic counterparts.
I wrote some 20 years ago, I wrote a piece about women in Hasidism, where I try to argue contrary to what I sense to be a fairly common view, whereby Hasidism was something of a feminist revolution in Judaism, where Hasidism liberated women, gave them equal rights, and there was evidence of this view being held in various types of popular literature, with certain names of female leaders of Hasidism cropping up time and again, most famously the Maid of Ludmir, the woman who has recently been the subject of a biography by Nathaniel Deutsch, which has popularized it even further. And I tried to argue, and to my mind, I succeeded in demonstrating that this was a myth. And I could show where it begins. Exactly, it begins in 1909 in a single publication by one Russian Jewish scholar, Shmuel Abba Horodetsky, in a little four-page, even shorter, article in a Russian language Jewish studies journal, Yevreiskaya Starina, where he reported for the first time oral traditions. He said tales, bobemises, basically, stories that the women, in old women in Volhynia, tell. And he recorded for the first time, and these traditions that he recorded include for the first time the story of the Maid of Ludmir, and he also mentions a number of other women like Odel, the daughter of the Baal Shem Tov, a few wives or widows or sisters of Hasidic leaders who exerted a lot of power and authority in the Hasidic world. And from that single little article in Russian, which Horodetsky himself, some 20 years later, when he published a four-volume history of Hasidism, and where for the first time we have a chapter dedicated to women in the Hasidic woman, in the Jewish woman in Hasidism, is the title, Aisha Hayudit Bachasidut. For the first time, somebody gives this space as a topic worthy of consideration. He develops what he recorded originally in Russian, very, very modestly and cautiously. It suddenly becomes a celebration of female leadership in Hasidism. And I try to show that this really was a myth, partly inspired by his own Zionist commitment, because by the time he wrote his book, he was already a fully committed Zionist. He had been exposed to German Jewish feminism in Berlin. Zionism itself had a certain strand of feminism, female liberationism, you know, the pioneering ideology. And he believed that Hasidism was a forerunner or a kind of could offer a traditionalist model for that. In reality, I don't believe that women, certainly not in early Hasidism, which operated as an exclusively male fraternity, there's even a question whether women ever were allowed to come into the Hasidic court, even just to receive a brocha, a blessing from the Rebbe. Certainly they were never allowed to sit and listen to the discourse of the Rebbe, to the Torah of the Rebbe, where there was a Torah. And that was virtually universal. Some Hasidic courts in the 19th century did allow women to come in, just to seek a bracha. Some of them forbade it, and I collected a lot of evidence to show that there were Hasidic rebbes who said, no women, I don't have any dealings with women, including, I might say, Chabad, as I shall say tomorrow in my talk, Chabad throughout the 19th century, no women. Statement after statement, women were not allowed to see the rebbe. He would have no dealings with them at all, certainly not personally. I shall talk about how he did. So my sense is that Hasidism originally is very much a male business. Women are on the periphery. They had a sense of belonging to it from the moment that Hasidism becomes something, and this doesn't happen until, I would say, the first quarter of the 19th century, when families begin to be born into Hasidism, when it becomes an inherited affiliation. So you know that you are born with an association to a particular Hasidic Rebbe in a particular region. And so the men would go and have relationship with the Rebbe and go to the court. The women would be the wives of the Hasidim or the daughters of the Hasidim or the sisters, but they had very little relationship with it themselves. I do, however, believe that there was a revolution in this respect in Chabad, and I think so far uniquely in Chabad, although there are all kinds of new things emerging now in this postmodern world of spirituality in Israel in particular, where there's kind of a lot of fermentation amongst women, including, for example, a whole cult now of the female Rebbe, the Maid of Ludmir, on the date of her, what I believe to be completely fictitious yahrzeit, at the place of her completely fictitious burial on Mount Olive. There is now an annual pilgrimage of women. There are now Torot of the Maid of Ludmir being circulated. There are some high priestesses of this cult whom I like and I respect and I understand what they're doing, because this is filling a genuine gap. There wasn't a female model, and it is a very constructive thing to do. But what it has to do with the historical reality of the matter is a different story. But in Chabad, I believe there really was a revolution, which began once again with the sixth Admor, with the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, in the 20s and 30s. What's that?
All questions from Flora will come afterwards, okay?
Yeah, okay. And which was taken, you know, huge leap forward by the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, where he didn't just intensify what his predecessor began, but he actually transformed it completely. And I think he put women at the center of his messianic project, although within certain constraints, and that will be the subject of my talk tomorrow.
Let me just make a short comment. Okay, because
I don't
know what Otto's going to say tomorrow. I don't want to take a chance on saying any of the similar things or anything stupid. I'll find out tomorrow if she doesn't. But, you know, Rabbi Kotlarsky, who's the head of the Shluchim of Lubavitch, he sometimes jokes with me that I'm the person after him who's been at the most Chabad houses, because I often give lectures and then often I'm traveling for some other reason, end up eating a meal or something or visiting. So, in any case, I just want to say one point, which is very important to realize, is that in fact the Rebbe created women clergy in Judaism. Mm-hmm. And this, I don't know if you can talk about it, I'll just keep quiet for having said that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the shluchot
exactly
are women clergy. What happens in the Chabad house is it's not just that there's a male, there's a rabbi. Mm-hmm. There is a team of husband and wife. Now, on some level, the old Rebbetzin was like that in, let's say, American shuls when women didn't go to work. On some level, she had many other duties. It was like you hired a rabbi and a rebbe, and you got them both together. But the fact is that with the new kinds of women's education and with the new roles of women in our society, he effectively created a female clergy, and that female clergy is functioning very successfully and gradually being imitated by other segments of the Orthodox community.
I'm going to ask one final question and then throw it open to the floor. And we've sort of been aiming towards there, and I think we've arrived there, which is the idea of how Hasidism, you know, reconciles to modernity. As modernity encroaches and poses significant challenges as well as opportunities for all religion, for all parts of religion and for all religions, I'm interested in how Hasidic communities have dealt with the modern world, and I'm interested in a practical level with things like entertainment, with things like going to university, with things like learning Torah full time versus taking on gainful employment, with things like finding a shidduch, a marriage partner, secular knowledge, and so on. And I'm wondering if I could pose this in two ways to the panel. Number one, how would they negotiate these contemporary issues? And also whether the way they would negotiate it is somehow different or distinguishable from how their counterparts in yeshiva, sort of mitnagdic ultra-orthodoxy, would do so.
The problem with this question is that it's too many questions rolled up in one.
Well,
and I think if try to attempt to answer all these questions, let me take the question of Hasidic and so-called misnagdic groups. It's very important to realize that the so-called misnagdic groups have increasingly adapted, if they are really what people call ultra-Orthodox, increasingly adopted social patterns of the Hasidic groups. And so such things as separation of the sexes in all kinds of contexts, such things as moving away from university education, dressing with a uniform, and other things like this have ended up becoming the norm among what we call yeshivish society. So increasingly, the question of how to negotiate modernity would not be distinguished between Hasidim and Misnagdim, even though Hasidim ironically have the advantage of this idea of trying to sanctify everything around, which Misnagdim do not, because the basic Misnagdish ideology is that there is certain which is really good and a certain which is really evil. Just stay the heck away from the stuff that's evil, and you can't transform it into good. So on this level, the Hasidim have an advantage, but in fact, the division is no longer Hasidim and Misnagdim. The division seems to be along a kind of left-right level, and therefore you will find that there are some kind of left-wing Hasidim who go to medical school or something like that, right? And it's a very small number. And you will find that there are some right-wing yeshivish people who actually are living like satmars. And I'd stay away with it to understand this. Now, I think the real problem about negotiating modernity is that we don't really know how to negotiate modernity, any of us, as Orthodox Jews, even if we think we do. And so all of us, like the people in this room, although from the looks of it, a lot of you are finished with this process. My wife and I are finished with this process. But when your children are growing up, you really worry about whether we've negotiated it properly. And depending on who you are, you have a different idea of what that means, what you want your children to achieve or to be. And you don't know whether you negotiated it properly until you get to maybe see what happened with another generation. So I think this is a very, very complicated set of issues that the Jewish community as a whole, and specifically the Orthodox Jewish community, is facing. And I think that we can tell that some have negotiated it by absolutely closing themselves off, and some by absolutely opening themselves up. But that's not us. And I don't mean just us in general. It's not even the Belzers or the Geras, right? Everybody is caught in the middle somehow. And in fact, our friends in Satmar just found themselves caught in it in a very strange way when those nuts from the Turei Karta, who represent themselves in a certain sense as the representatives of the Satmars, went to Iran, and the Satmars had to face another aspect of modernity and define a new kind of non-harmful anti-Zionism as their ideology. Now, so the point that I want to make, it's the last sentence I'm going to say about this, is that I don't know whether one can generalize about this, but this is the challenge that everybody faces.
Anybody else?
Yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Recently, there came into my possession a very interesting document. There was a very famous machloket within Chabad at the turn of the 20th century between Lubavitch, that was the Rebbe Rashab, Reb Shalom Dovber, and Babroisk, who was his first cousin, the Rebbe Babroisk of Shmaya Noach, and they both have the last name of Schneerson. These are two kissing cousins. And I had always heard that, as often happens in families, the machlokas was about money, you know. In fact, many years ago, I visited in a nursing home in Williamsburg called Eshel Avram, Reb Chaim Lieberman, who was a great bibliographer, and he was the librarian of the sixth Rebbe, and a very close confidant of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. And I asked him what that machlokas was all about between Lubavitch and Babroisk. And he told me no issues, just money. But it seems that this is not true, because, as I said, I've now come into possession of this document, which is the Babroisker's rejoinder to the Lubavitcher Rebbe of that time, the fifth Rebbe, Rav Sholem Dovber, and the touchstones, the Sal'ei HaMachloket, are incredible. And it really is going to be a response to your question. What are the issues? The Rebbe Rashab gave priority to the Chabad settlement in Hebron, which was a very old Chabad community, and downplayed the importance of the more recent Chabad settlement in Yerushalayim. And the reason, or at least one of the reasons, was he felt that in Hebron, where I lived for many years, in such a provincial setting, the Hasidim would better be equipped to preserve their lifestyle. This is in the year 1909. He was afraid that if they would live in Yerushalayim, they would be exposed to the allure of cosmopolitan Yerushalmi society, such as bibliotheken, libraries, with secular books, and they would thereby become corrupted. And the Babroiska says something amazing. He says, do you think in Hebron there aren't little bibliotheken? In other words, this approach to modernity is unrealistic. Now, these days I live in Rockland County, New York. We have Square, which would be an analog to the way the Rebbe Rashab envisioned Hebron. You have a municipality, Square, New Square, Square. No outsiders are allowed to live there. And it's a desperate attempt to insulate against modernity, against the encroachments of modernity. Now, living in such close proximity, I can't live in Square, especially on the Kuknik, but it would be difficult. But I live in very close geographic proximity, and that means that I know a lot of the inhabitants of Square. And Ada, you would be amazed at what is going on among the Square women. Okay. Mm-hmm. A cousin of mine who is an adherent of Chabad is a personal trainer to many of the Square women. These women are really with it, you know.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. I mean, I can see this coming. Yeah.
You know, and I can tell you some fascinating stories. Well, I don't think time permits. But anyway, so what we've raised here really goes back to this machlokas in 1909 between the Rebbe Rashab of Lubavitch and Reb Shmaya Noach Schneerson of Bobrovsk.
I'd like you to give all of these people a warm hand. And although the hour is late, we have some time for questions from the floor. If people have questions, they should come up and approach the mic and make your questions to the point, if there are any. That means all the way up here. It's in my hand. I'm gonna collect. You have to come right up and grab it. I'm going to collect the questions one at a time, and then we'll answer them all as a group. Okay? And please specify who the question is for. I'll think.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming to address us. I think people here may have a general question about why you're not actually talking about the content of Hasidut, because the title of the evening is Hasidut, the Search for Spirituality. I just want to say that, you know, as a person who came out of Israel and was part of the Habakkuk scene, I can only say that one of the things that I miss now living here in Toronto temporarily is that nobody talks about Avodas Hashem and wanting to come closer to Hashem. And I think that the bottom line of the people who are drawn together in this, what you've labeled the Habakkuk movement, are simply wanting to come closer to Hashem and not caring about where you're going to get it from. Just get the spirituality from wherever you can. And I, for one, can say that in my own life, I found it in the content of Chabad Hasidus. I find it in Breslau Hasidus. I find it in attending Karl Bach Minyanim. And I don't care if people have contempt for it, because that's what's going to bring me closer to God. And so what's the problem with that? And why are you not talking about the content of Hasidut?
I don't really have a question. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I'm not a hippie, but I've met, I knew Shlomo Carlbach. I've seen him in four different cities. I drove him someplace once. I knew him quite well. And I never forgot this. Once in probably the late 80s, I was with a Chavurah group, and we spent an evening, men and women together, just listening to Shlomo Carlbach do his thing. And it was very touching and very moving. I've heard him many times. Then the next day, he did, there was a Simchas Torah rally for Soviet Jewry. And I was invited later to a private party. And somebody said he was only, he really was outreach for the less religious people. Well, this was wall-to-wall yeshiva bachers. It was unbelievable. It was something really, really special and just something I'd never forget. And they were all really into his music. So I just wanted to emphasize that.
So it sounds like there's one question from the floor, and I'm going to answer that question. The tone and tenor of the evening was because of the questions I asked. So I didn't ask specifically about Hasidic content, mostly because to me that is something that's very difficult to do within the context of a short program. I've always felt that to unravel ideas properly, they need to be done in proper time. The goal of this evening is really to look at the sort of progression of Hasidut from its origins to modernity and see certain trends in it. But the question is well taken. Thank you very much and good night.
Two more answer questions.